following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Houser, Channel Lumpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. What you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
So we're having our weekly Shefa, and this is All of the Above with Norman Lear. The guy who just said Norman Lear is that fellow. He's sitting with his friend Paul Hip.
Hi, Norman.
Who is far more than hip. And
with two P's.
And we're expecting a guy who's far more than hip and Lear and Penn. And I just, as a matter of fact, stumbled across his name.
Across Sean's?
I didn't know I was going to say Penn. And
look at how that just came out.
It just happened. And Sean Penn will be here any moment.
Author Sean Penn. Author.
Author Sean Penn. Actor Sean Penn. Writer Sean Penn. Producer. Director. And overall good fellow.
Yeah.
I don't know if he would agree with that. I've got to ask him if he thinks of himself as a good fellow.
We'll lead off with that when he gets here. Oh, wait a minute.
When he gets here, there he is.
He's here.
Coming in the door. Listen to that crowd. My God, how people carry on.
Sean.
Hello, Mr. Penn. How are you?
Hello, Mr. Lear. Very well. Hello, Mr. Hip.
Welcome.
So we were just talking about you and wondering whether, because I had called, spoken to you as a good fellow, wonder if you think of yourself as a good fellow.
I think my go-to consolation when things are difficult is that worse things have happened to better people. And so so I think I'm going to hold on to that for the time being.
That's a good idea.
Well, now, who is there anybody on the face of the earth that couldn't say that?
That couldn't say?
But worse things have happened to better people.
Yeah, true.
It's a good go-to.
It's a great go-to.
Yeah, really true.
Huh?
But I think that question about do you think of yourself as a good fellow, do you think of yourself as a good fellow normally?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I wish to be, I hope to be, I try to be. I mean, I don't, you know. I'm sure there are people that have problems with me.
No.
Lots of them are listening now.
Yeah, I think with those kinds of things, it's always a good idea to be able to, when one doubts themselves, to zero out and be just a little bit better the next day. And, you know, it's hard to know sometimes how to be a good fella. Sometimes the best intentions go very wrong and one can wrestle with themselves about decisions that they made and so on and weigh that in the balance. But yes, the answer is I think I'm a pretty good fella. I see it in the eyes of my kids.
Oh, that's
that's
nice.
The place to look. That is the place to look. But everybody doesn't see that necessarily in the face of their kids. I've known a number of such situations.
Yeah.
But I think I see it in the face of my kids, too, whose faces I just love to look at. Mm-hmm.
I think as we get older, it gets easier to let go of the mistakes of yesterday and just go, all right, there's no, like, over and next. There's no redoing that because we've tried enough times to no avail. Then you go, I'll do better tomorrow.
Did I tell you about over and next?
No.
I have felt for some time that we don't give enough credit to those two simple little words, over and next. When something is over, it is fucking over, and we are on to next. And if there was a hammock in the middle of those two words, that would be the best description I know of living in the moment. Mm. That moment between over and next.
Yeah. Which is where the good stuff is, in the moment. And in this moment, Bob Honey, the new book.
Who Do Good Stuff, is that?
Yeah. Tell us about this. Where did this come from?
So I think when I look back, I've been procrastinating writing my first novel for 50 years, which would have put me at 7 when I first thought about it. And you know, born in 1960, I think that there were so many parallel things going on, at least through the eyes of by 1968, of an 8-year-old me, you know, a kind of the violence in and out of the country, the movements, both productive movements and less productive movements, the media I'll put on the side, and that I think that had a substantially different place in American culture than it has today. But so many things were similar, and then when I think what finally got me off my ass to write this thing is seeing what had happened, particularly over, let's say, the last 15 years, in terms of the celebrityism of the culture and what part we all played in bringing too much value to too little.
That's a good way of putting it. Too much value to too little. And excess, making excess the biggest of our products.
Yeah, once upon a time, the idea of branding, which I talk about a lot in the book, was a kind of a case to make, to create an affection between a human being and an inanimate object. And now people are branding themselves more often than not. And so we're creating kind of a false affections, unearned, and not very nutritious in most cases.
Mm-hmm. Wow, yeah, that would take the place of, fill that place of any real connection, right? So we end up full of this fake affection, connection.
And we've got the machinery to do it.
Yeah.
In the way that we communicate, whether it's by text or email.
Or Facebook
or FaceTime even.
Which I'm always fascinated when I look at Facebook, the things that people put on there, the things that's the place where people go. I mean, someone dies and they put their feelings on face. It seems so odd to me now. We have to forget. We forget how we got to here.
Yeah. I think
it's not normal.
No, and it's not Orwell's Big Brother, because Orwell's Big Brother wasn't we ourselves.
Right. Right. It's something we couldn't have imagined. We are Big Brother.
We are Big Brother.
Oh man. So, yeah, there's several novels in that.
I intend there to be.
Oh, fantastic. Wait, so this has been going on since you were a kid?
Well, just in the sense of really, you know, writing and procrastinating, really, to get to a point where I would sit down and commit to whatever that particular moment was. Because I think from whatever conscious years about considering a novel, it was always going to be written very currently, you know, reflecting, but in terms of the principal narrative, to write something that was as current as I could get.
Yeah.
How hard did you work on this?
I wrote the book in 30 days, and I rewrote it for 2 years very, very, very diligently, because there's a kind of in that there is a humor that I tested. I had to have proof of theory, because I can be guilty of laughing at my own jokes, as my kids will often attest. So I had to find that the humor that I was after was accessible, if not to many, to some. That somebody could read this and get it without me helping them along. And so once I found some people that really got it, then I knew that the way that I was starting to navigate it over the 2 years, and also starting to, because I'm brand new to it, and because I wanted to make sure that, unlike in my personal life, where I can often expect people to understand me by osmosis, that the book that I wrote was available to be shared. And so that took 2 years.
Wow.
So, when we first sat, before we turn on the mic, And we were talking about it. You had had a great time reading it and really understood it. And I mentioned that I had a difficult time. And I was the, as you talked about, somebody looking at it, having to read it a second time. You quoted a woman, I forget her name. I had to read it a second time. And that second time, I read it two or three times. Because I stopped and went back over the paragraph and back.
I had to do a lot of that too. It was no easy stroll.
Yeah,
it's dense.
So that's why I asked you how hard was it to write, because every single sentence seemed handcrafted.
Excuse me. It is, and it's, and it was a kind of, you know, there's a, there's an enormous amount of alliteration in it. There's a. I was once one of the people that who really embraced the book and got it as the writer, Paul Theroux. And but at some point he had written me an email and he pointed out one of the words I used and he said, not a word. And then he went, but then he backed up and said that a friend of his was once editing an Iris Murdoch novel. And he had written to Iris Murdoch about a word she'd used, not a word, and she wrote back, "It is now." and there was a lot of that in this because so much of it is a rhythmic thing. So there were times where I would make up words. There are a lot of acronyms in it. There's a lot of, you know, as it's footnoted fiction, the kind of extreme that I wanted it to be was going to even violate my current state as a reader, in a sense that I didn't know that were it not my book that I would be patient enough to try to find the music that I knew, you know, inside was there. But that was part of it, because I also felt that we're not working hard enough to understand things. We're kind of, you know, the things that are made easy or excerpted for us, or that we can, you know, go to Wikipedia on, and this is how we get to know times, places, things, and people too often now. And so I thought, you know, if I really do this, just the absolute commitment to that was funny to me.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So then the whole process was one of being able to step away from the current news, which was not making me laugh very much these days, and to laugh a lot, even in the process of writing.
Yeah, I found that. Yeah, it wasn't an easy read. It was. It's a tough read. You got to earn it, man. And then I went back over it. And another book that I did that with, and I don't know if it's a comparison, but it was a similar experientially. So this is a direct comparison. It was Naked Lunch. You know, Burroughs' Naked Lunch, which is different in that it uses cut and paste thing. But that was a book that I read. And I knew there's something in there, but I didn't get it. And I had to go back over it and reread it. And I found this. There's a subversive sense of humor. There's a really – it's a subversive kind of quality to this that reveals itself, you know, where you go, okay, is he – are we in on the same joke? Is he letting me in on a joke? Do I see the joke? And he's not getting – what's going on here?
Yeah, I think a lot of people who have read it, especially when I've read some of the fantastic, you know, blasting criticisms, that it's been clear to me that in their decision to take certain things seriously, some of the kind of Baroque language it almost had needed packaging for them saying, this is not serious.
Right. And a disclaimer.
And I think that if I were to, you know, put something on the cover of this book to help people understand it, it would be, this is a love letter to the best of this country disguised as an equal opportunity high offender.
Well, it's a love letter. The word savage came up to me several times. It's a love letter from somebody who is unhappy with what he is seeing. Mm-hmm. And several times I felt that the work was to cover the savage feeling, the restless, unhappy feeling with what is going on.
Yeah, and that is, and because, as it's also a novel, not an opinion piece, I think that when I was looking at the characters, it was not something that, you know, I think it would suffer in direct attribution to me in the sense this is fiction. And even the sort of absence of hope, which again, hope, it seems to me, is not a thing we have a lot of choice about. So it becomes a kind of conceit when we talk about the notion of not having hope. There's no choice. You know, we either drop into a box or we have some kind of hope. But we seem to be in a culture of complaint, a culture of without accountability. It's very easy for everyone to point their finger at this, you know, I think fair to say, buffoon who's currently living in our White House. But the putting the power in a buffoon's hands was us. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I was unhappy about, that I wanted to step away and be able to also laugh about. And so it's really much more of a picture as a novel about it's how it could be a how to write satire in a time of satire experiment.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a great concept. I read that you one of the great things of writing this was that it's you and the page. There's no producers. There's no notes. There's no none of that. How great was that? What was that like artistically for you? Because you've written before. Did you write any of your films like Indian Runner? Did you write the script?
I've written originals and adapted books like Into the Wild. And there were a couple of things that were so freeing about doing this. Is, you know, any screenwriter can multiply their budget exponentially with one sentence of screen description. And so you become inherently self-censoring in some way. Because when you start to write, you're looking to see that it get made. It may not be that you're thinking, well, I'm going to compromise the creative this. But you are. Well, of course you are, because film is so damn expensive. And in this, I could write anything I wanted and never look back. I love that about it. I also think that, you know, and I don't know that there's anybody, I don't mind saying, with Norman Lear in the room, I don't think there's anybody that has proven the strength of working well with others. And that's how we lead in the best of what we can give film or television or the theater and so on.
Right.
Whereas in writing, what happened with me is I just started to get to the point where I didn't feel that I was enjoying playing well with others. Certainly, it was still the demand. It was the only thing I knew how to offer something. But increasingly, and this may have had to do with finding that among my peers and others, it was becoming more of a marketplace where colleagues on the creative side were more interested in selling movies than making them, that there was a certain kind of heartbreak in that, and maybe that was bad luck, but in either, you know, in terms of experiences that I'd had, but it cumulatively drove me to that hunger to have something that was just mine.
Yeah.
And I like that workspace. I you know, a lot of times they'll talk about what a solitary experience it is to write a novel. I had a blast doing it, and I needed to have a blast, because I think that's the other thing when you're in any hard time, or you look at people who've lived in countries of great struggle and great oppression, they get involved in the fight, and they get so involved in the fight, they forget the joy that they're fighting for, or the quality of life they're fighting for themselves or for others. And I really somewhere it clicked, and I knew I had to step out of that and yet not take my eye off it. And so Bob Honey, Who Just Do Stuff, is a book that's eye is very clearly on it.
Yeah.
But more, there's more dancing and laughing going on in the way it's on it.
Yeah. That had been a freeing place to drop into, just a great, like a renewing place. Because it's the fun of creativity returned.
Yeah. And I also think, you know, as somebody who, in my ways and the ways that I knew how, I made a lot of efforts over the years to step into the fray and into the debate and in hope of helping to affect change in certain ways. And I say, well, look, I'm not going to take it all on my shoulders. That would take in a lot of hubris. But look what it's got us. Mm. Look where we are.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for me to go out and you know, get into my opinions about where we are today, having, you know, done that and not feeling that the contribution had, at least to date, had not been something that I could quantify positively, that it was a good time for me to step back. And one of the things that I, you know, I did know that the critical aspect of the critical perspective on this book, I knew there would be an awful lot of attribution that would get in critics' way, mm-hmm. or that whether it be the Schadenfreude of others or whatever, that there would be a frenzy. But the same writer, Jane Smiley, who had suggested she had to read the book twice to really get it, suggested to me that she thought that 25% of its readers would love it and that 75% would loathe it. And I realized that that was a much better ratio than I've had in my personal life. So I feel ahead of the game now with this book.
I would say there'd be 25 that would be confused, but happily so. Right? I would get 25% would love it, 25% would be confused, 50% may loathe it.
Well, I'm going to let you do the math.
But in a sense, it all five. I don't know anybody who has shared more of himself than you have over the years, and across the globe. I mean, you've given your instinct and your sensibility and sensitivity and your body and your it just now, as I think about it, it follows naturally that you would also offer your intellect and your insight and so forth.
Well, without accusing myself of giving, you know, I've tried. And then this, but in this case, really, it's much more selfish in a sense, because there's even a line about the character Bob Honey in the book where I can't remember exactly what I wrote, but something to the effect of he has dreams of assassination for terms like me time. And conversely, for me, this was me time. I was gonna write my damn novel.
Was the process, was there a process where, as you said, you wrote it in 30 days, spent 2 years rewriting it. Then in the rewriting, was there a process where you find your voice and then you just start just rocking? I mean, like making up words, I imagine just words pouring out at such a rate that you just, something pops in your head, you put it down.
You know, there were so many times that I've always considered myself and had to work very hard knowing that I have a very short bandwidth of retention. Even, you know, when I think back on some of the books I've read and loved, I remember the tune more than I remember the lyrics, let's say. And what happened here is that, you know, and I'd had similar experience often as an actor, where once you find the kind of voice or the music of a character and you work on it in improvisation, there's a vocabulary that comes that was not the vocabulary you might yourself use about the same subject. And many times, because I wrote the book often dictating, there would be words that felt right in the music of the character that I had never
as
bothered.
You spoke.
Yeah, as I spoke it. Words I had a familiar, I'd heard them spoken. I'd probably read them in books, but I'd never used them or actually known what they meant. Mm-hmm. But more often than not, when I would go back and look it up to see if I'd made a sentence that made any sense, I had used the word correctly.
Wow.
So relative to your question, there became, once one started to trust that more and more,
Yeah.
Then, you know, you just start to riff. It's not the only way, of course, because this is the density of this thing is such that I came to words in a lot of ways, from instinct to knowledge to the thesaurus to the dictionary to what to just being in the process of writing and discovering a word and something I might be reading that really compelled me. Because it is a very, you know, some of, for me, the humor of the book is this kind of massive indulgence in language. But it's also a step away from language that seems to have been too captive for too long. Mm-hmm. So that's been, that was, you know, a lot of what this was to me. And then because there's the main character, Bob Honey, there's also that which another writer might call a muse. And in this case, which is just that zone therein, or that voice that is telling the whole story. And in this case, I wanted to make that a character and give it a name. So the voice who is telling Bob's story is a character who was also free to have that kind of music.
Yeah. Yeah, which is a great device because then, as you said, you do anything you want. Yeah. And Bob can do anything you want. Yeah, it's fantastic. That's I like you. You guys have that in common. That Norman, when we were talking about writing, it was what you said to me is just get the phone or get a dictaphone. You've always written by talking into a recorder, haven't you?
Well,
one of the ways.
Yeah, it happened that I don't know, but I wish I could remember the year. But it was in the late 70s. And I had a severe writer's block. I had to deliver. I was at Tennessee Ernie Ford show. Do you remember Tennessee Ernie
sure.
Ford?
Yep.
So it's a half hour show. It was a half hour show. And I was responsible for the monologue. The morning that we were to gather around a table at 10 o'clock for the next week, that night I had to deliver the monologue, which was, you know, 2.5 pages. And I would be talking to a shrink at 1 o'clock in the morning with the pages due, you know, around a table at 10. And, you know, at 2:30 or something, I'd write 2 pages. I'd get it done at by 3:45 or something.
Yeah. Dictating.
And no.
Sitting down writing, old
sitting
school.
Sitting down
right?
writing, yeah. And then... another shrink said to me, you know, 50 people in a small room and one door and somebody else fire and they all rush to the door and everybody's not going to get out if they're crushed at the door. If they started to go out two at a time, they might all get out. He said, think of your ideas the same way. You know, get them out first. You might think of dictating. You know, it doesn't matter what order they're in. It doesn't matter, you know, where the short or the tall, you know, if you're thinking of people. Anyway, that saved my ass.
Yeah.
Because I started to dictate from then on into a machine. And somebody came in very early in the morning and transcribed it before I got to the office.
Yeah.
It was life-saving.
Did you get into, because what I also read, not to keep comparing this to beat writers, because there's a lot more than that in there, but I think about Kerouac and the rhythmic nature of things. And there was a couple things went on reading this. One was, you start reading it just like you're reading somebody's book, and then you're going to get, wait, hold on. And then I was like, oh, I see what you're doing with the language and all that stuff. The other thing was the rhythm of it. It seems to come and go for me. So I was wondering if that was the intention. There seems to be rhythm that comes in, and you can read it in that Kerouac or pick your writer you like who writes in that kind of style.
Try Penn.
You know? No, but I'm comparing. That's
I already confessed my issues of retention to some of the Kerouac I've read. That would apply also. So I can't say specifically where there are direct parallels or not. But what I did here, you know, there is in a kind of license of the book, there's a devotion that Bob has to this, you know, oft-quoted foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds.
Emerson.
Yes. And so that also was part of the rule book of this no rules book. And yet, you know, by no rules book, I really mean there is a rule book. It takes finding what the rules are. It took finding them for me also. And so, for example, there are times where the thoughts that are going on in Bob's head, when they're expressed in rhyme, you'll find you were in a dream. There are different kind of colors that then remain consistent. And what I did, and I wouldn't want to talk too specifically about it because I one of the things I love coming out of film is to let the reader be the director.
Hmm.
But I did, in the 2 years of work, it was go back, navigate, commit, have a Bible that was solid, one that I could understand where I was going to go somewhere in a certain attack and where I wasn't. And then there's an aspect to this where the music changes and it becomes kind of a lament. And that's in things that are most personal to the character that is Bob, who is this otherwise social outcast, but in search of the same kind of, you know, whenever we're talking about ideals that have been chipped away at, or an idealist who has become battered and found a moral compass, perhaps perverse in this case, all his own. Hmm. The search is still for a certain kind of retouch with innocence. And so when those moments come, they take on their own language.
Wow.
Can you, because we don't have pages open in front of us, but can you illustrate that? Can you think of a passage that makes that?
I could dig into my jacket and find my glasses, and I can probably find a passage.
And Paul Hipp has a copy of the book, Bob Honey, Who Just Do Stuff.
So this, yes, as I said, this is when Bob is taking this drive across America. The America Bob drives from Woodview to New Orleans is not that one of lore, not the one he'd known in his earliest cross-continental automotive excursions, not the one of pay-later gas stations, vintage diners, and two-lane roads. Only the trains remain in tribute to that spirit refuge now vanquished by modernity's craven trumpery. Vanquished, as if by lightning, blinding burdensome myths and dispensing misbehaviors exposed. Perhaps a truth worth grabbing and holding on to for dear life, that where life is really lived in the simple places of love and happiness. Bob owned neither. And in lieu of that, only solitude would suffice. There were few remaining romantic vistas experienced in the seclusion of reclusive roadways. In their place, interstates, strip malls, retail emporiums, traffic, roadwork, and bottlenecks. America, it seems to Bob, is no longer that beautiful girl who'd birthed him, but instead the ghost of a girl he'd never known.
Mm, yeah.
I love that last line.
See, that's where people should get that book and get to that.
Did I hear a made-up word in there?
You might have. Norman, you might have. There could be all over the place.
Yeah.
Something sounded right, I went with it.
I wasn't smart enough to get it on my own. You had said earlier that had happened.
So where are you at with film? You kind of going to go back to...
I don't find myself enjoying film as a place, in a place as an actor.
Yeah.
At this stage. So I don't... I'm not, you know, going to announce some grand retirement or anything like that. I there are great filmmakers who... if they had 2 days of work that I thought I could gear up for. But I remember once being working in the theater. I was doing a Sam Shepard play in San Francisco. And my cell phone never rang backstage because it was all an old theater with the stone walls, and we were in the bowels of it.
Right.
And back in the dressing room areas during a break from the rehearsal. And my cell phone rang, and it was Marlon Brando, who I hadn't spoken to in about 4 months, and he didn't know that I was in San Francisco doing a play, and he said, you know, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm actually in rehearsal for a play. There was a long pause, and then he said, the idea of doing a play for me, for him, would be like summoning up the Inquisition. And that is how I feel about, you know, really taking on one you got to get suited up for.
Yeah. Is it because, have you lost the connection, like just interest in, is it the process or is it the way things have radically changed in the last 5 years, you know? I mean, has this fun been sucked out of it or have you just kind of moved on?
Well, you know,
for now.
I've been doing it for a long time, yeah, without break, largely with, you know, very time-intense commitments to material and places and people and things that become, you know, with every time you take a job as an actor, you're going to limit, I am anyway, not very good at stereophonic thinking. And so wherever I was as a human being at the time I committed to the choices that were going to make that character, I was not going to let myself learn much more till I was done. Mm-hmm. I was going to work within the same first choices and within that framework that I would have graphed from page 1 to 120.
Yeah.
And so I've more and more felt frustrated not only by that but by every little thorn in the brushes you walk through while you're doing it, whether it be personalities, egos, none any more than my own as a problem, all of that stuff. And I just got to where I wanted to work alone.
Yeah. And the book.
And you can't get more alone than writing that novel.
Right.
Which I love that. And tell us about, you took a full-page ad recently. Yeah. New York Times Washington Post. Do tell us about that.
So yes,
because I think it's an extension of the book.
Yeah, because the way that people find out, principally get their news these days, especially pop culture, is going to be, you know, they're going to type something into their phone or their computer, look up the thing, and most things are going to be weighed in whatever negative there is first. And in this case, I had. earned so much negative attention for this. And by earned, I don't necessarily mean, you know, I'll let other people decide whether it's in the way I wrote this book. But I was aware of people in the world who were less than fans of who they thought I was and what baggage that was going to carry into it. So while I was writing the book, I was imagining many times vicious reviews. And what happened is when vicious reviews came, they came many times word for word at the kind of base level I expected them. So there was one that was, honestly, shut your face, Sean Penn. And that was like Marie Claire magazine or something like that. There were some real doozies. So what happened is that when Simon & Schuster was going to put a full-page ad, we'd all talked about what it should be, and we thought we should only use the worst of the worst. And then, just like the book, where, you know, if one's going to come to appreciate this book, you have to kind of work and explore it. We'll go back to it, but one of the words that's in there, trumpery, because we'll go back to what I was reading, is a word. And it's footnoted fiction, so it's kind of dazzling to find what a word like that means. But what happened was, in the same way you have to go and explore to understand some of this stuff as a reader in the novel itself, we thought, well, you should have to explore to find the good reviews. So you get to the end of the full-page ad with all of these scathing reviews, and then it says, but if you want counterpoints from Paul Theroux, Salman Rushdie, Jane Smiley, Stuart Dybbuk, et cetera, these great writers, you know, go to this site. And then that's where you get those. So it was – so I've got this now for – I just got back from New York. And if only for the framing of having that in my house, those scathing reviews, it will all have been worth it.
By the way, listener, there is glee in Sean's eyes as he told us he started to talk about that ad.
How did Simon & Schuster react to the idea initially?
They have been – I don't – you know, this is my, you know, first rodeo with a publisher and writing a book and so on. And I got to say, I'm either very lucky or it's the business I should have been in all my life. I've had a great editor, Peter Borland, who's been significant in all of these decisions. So it's, yeah, this has been a hoot, and it became a national bestseller. And so I'm just riding with that and really have been enjoying also going around the country and doing these moderated conversations, because the people that are the moderators are local and in many cases lauded authors. So in the same way I might have had a history of seeing a movie, meeting an actor at the screening of that movie who's in it that I had not known before, sitting down for a drink, you can kind of touch quickly on where they approach something from. And I had not come to be able to articulate my own process. But writers could read the book and say, I know how you approached this. And they were right. And so it's been this great, you know, person. Each one of them has given me a kind of better framing of the game.
And you're meeting readers? You said it's a national bestseller. Meeting the people out there that have read the book has to be satisfying, the people that got it. It's almost like the establishment people. So you're taking the piss out of the establishment people with the ad. And then there's the rest of us that went, okay, I get it. These people have never loved this subversive.
Well, you know, one of the chapters is chapter headings, titles, is about the seeking homeostasis in inherent hypocrisy. And, you know, one could easily, you know, I can easily accept how there are people who would consider me part of the bourgeoisie. It doesn't take the fighter against the bourgeoisie out of you if you used to load trucks for Roadway Express, as I did. So there's still, I still enjoy seeing the rich man slip on the banana peel.
That's great. Yeah. Now, there's an aspect of you mentioned what people bring to their opinion one way or the other about you, what they might bring to the book. You know, it seems more and more in today's society, in the news, what it's become, the celebrity-driven thing, that you've actually done, you're in a unique position, you've actually used your resources to go down, like, to New Orleans because you could. Like, what a lot of people think, I'd like to go down there and help those people. You went down and got a boat and saved a bunch of people, and then you took a bunch of shit for it from some quarters, you know? Is that the kind of stuff that you're coming up against? Like, where people don't like Sean Penn because he went...
You just uttered the metaphor for the book.
Yeah.
The book and that story.
Right. Right. Haiti.
One and the same.
Yeah, that asshole went over and helped people in Haiti.
Right.
I hate him. What the fuck?
Well, you know, I've always been a believer that no good deed will go unpunished. But I have to say that when the really liberating thing about writing a book, and a book that I stand by every word. I worked, and did. What's in this book is what I is what I wanted to write.
Yeah,
and in a very unique way versus a film, because you know it's often been said that you don't finish a film, you abandon it. Well, simply because the money is running, and you got to make choices. And with this, I finished it, and I'm going to finish another one. And if it's when it's loved, that's great. When it's liked, fantastic. When it's questioned, that's good. But when it's hated, I don't have crew that I had come to set away from their families and work 12 hours with pride about the material who are suffering with that.
Yeah.
So it's just me and my, I don't mind saying I'm 57 and my pool is heated. So I'm fine with it. And to not have other people's concerns and work on it, ridiculed maybe because you had a part in it.
Yeah.
You know? You can, you know, or because you're the director of something and the way that you made the thing, framed the pieces, is other people don't like, and so maybe the actors suffer for it or vice versa.
Yeah.
So you, in this case, it's all on me, and I really like that.
Yeah.
Do you understand how grown up all of that is, that thinking? that feeling, what you just said. It's very mature, very grown up.
Well, I do think...
Do you think of yourself as grown up as I'm trying to express?
Here's what I think. I think that... I remember hearing a long, long time ago from someone that, you know, once they had gotten to a certain age, looked back on their lives and said, boy, I wish I had had a lot more real concerns and a lot less phantom ones. And I think that I've finally gotten to a point where, while none of us can expect that we can't have a major setback in some way, there's people we care about, there's our own health we care about, there's a lot of things going on in the world that we care about. But I think that my basic nature every day is getting up, despite everything that's going on, and feeling very good, and that's become consistent. So I'd like to think I remember, it's something of a recent shift, because, and I think it started with writing the book, where I never remember having a fear of death, but I had a great fear that when I died, I would never have become the person I knew I should be, if only in so much as enjoying the moment, yeah, undistracted, or despite the things going on around it, let's say. And I think that, I recognize that I'm at that place.
That is so great.
I think essential to that is what you touched on earlier, which is... For me, at about to be 55, when Trump was elected, it was so shocking. Everybody was shocked. But I also felt a bit had. Not just had by the media, but I'll even say specifically the MSNBC of it, all the people that I thought were my friends, all the stuff I was getting. And I just decided, 20 years ago, before this phone and Twitter and all the shit, the constant news cycle, you could read a newspaper and stay very well informed. So I figured I would cut all that extraneous shit out, because I can't afford it. Maybe other people can afford it. I personally, I can't, and I tried, like you were talking about. On my own smaller scale than you, I tried to affect some change, and I wrote some protest songs, and I put some stuff out, and I felt had. So for me, it's been painting. Now, Norman, I would ask you this. Is there a time during your long life being active in stuff? Because if one runs the risk of apathy, it's not apathetic. You can stay informed and stay active, but protect yourself, right? Creatively, spiritually, all of that. Well, I would ask both of you. If Sean, is that something that you feel like?
It's funny how things happen at certain times. If there was ever me having to be concerned that I'd be apathetic, it wouldn't be because I wasn't in a moment where I was ready to be proactive.
Yeah.
It would be because I didn't know if I hadn't remembered the last time that something outside of my own thoughts gave me hope. Of course, your kids do. You have a commitment to that, even when you have to pretend.
Right.
But then when this horrible thing happened in Parkland, and within 2 days of these kids being under this kind of horrific battlefield-like fire with that caliber of weapon against stone walls and corridors and the mutilated and dead bodies of their friends, and at 14, 15, 16, 17 years old, to within just days of that, be on television and be speaking, not with a finger waving at anybody, but with this incredible articulation, composure, inclusion, compassion, intelligence about the issue and what they'd been through,
yeah,
and what they want. I thought, if there was, again, it becomes this thing where we are either pretending that we don't have hope because we're scared, we're avoiding hope because we don't want to play in the game that commits to something where we might lose, or we're killing ourselves. But there's no other option on hope.
Yeah.
And they that's the, when the, those reminders come in, it really kicks you in the ass, and you say, hey, okay, you know, let's see what tomorrow's going to bring.
Yeah.
Or maybe, you know, the purity that comes with youth is as you were saying that, I wonder if, well, it's something I find again and grasp and tend to lose and then grasp again over years, over months, perhaps years. I thought that when you were talking about this place you've reached, which is glorious to hear. And I thought, you know, I've reached that too, but I haven't always held on to it.
Yeah.
It slips away.
Mm. Yeah, these are it's what in tactical training they call perishable skills. We whether it's people training in evasive driving or in weapons or any of these things, you have to constantly retrain for these things to be ready for you. And when we talked before we went on the air about the Bruce Springsteen show on Broadway.
Yeah.
He talks about that. He talks about what's the job of the artist. And I can't quote him and wouldn't want to try to – but paraphrasing it, what I took from what he said that really, really touched me was that the job of the artist is to remind us of that reflective moment, that moment when we let ourselves feel all of the cells and being vulnerable and being clear-minded and being generous and all the best things in ourselves that make us present in the moment. And you know, it's not whether – he had ever worked in a factory or not. It was, could he give you a meditation in a song that would bring you to that place, whether it was a up-tempo meditation or a very hypnotic one? And he, of course, is a great storyteller and a great musician. He's done both. And now with this show, he's actually sharing what that the obligation of the artist is. And I've found that very complete and moving.
Yeah. It's, to protect that, though, to protect that place that you're working from.
Yeah.
It's important, I think.
Yeah. You know, and
it's under siege now.
Yeah, and I think the big trick is...
It's under siege now out in the culture or...
Well, all the incoming shit, you know... If you're an artist trying to hold on to that thing, that place, there's a place of purity there, right? That we're, you know.
Yeah, and with that, we can't live in a denial of the darkest parts of our nature, of human nature, and what's happening. I mean, Norman Mailer had said at some point of this century that this century is the first century that mankind may not complete. And I think that's true. So you can have hope. But only if you recognize and you look the devil in the eye on what's happening and are willing to engage it. If only, you know, I talk a lot in the book about weapons and explosives, and I used to watch the Surgery Channel.
There's a Surgery Channel.
There used to be a Surgery Channel, and I'd get hysterical laughing. Because not because of the hardship of the patient or anything like that, and certainly not with genital or eyes or pediatric surgery. But the rest, I could get hysterical just seeing how at the end of the day we're all reduced to the same thing once you cut into the body and all of that stuff. It's kind of humbling. And then really laugh hysterically and cry with laughter when it would be a voluntary cosmetic surgery because it's so because it's so violent and so on. And when in the book, one of the things that would, you know, kind of really get me giggling is to talk about weapons as though at their core they're a serious thing. They're a serious thing because of the ridiculous way that we use them and the ridiculous reason for many of them being in existence in the first place, which to or somehow to kill other human beings. Is, but for the real world, a ridiculous comic notion. And if we were in a sane world, it's simple right now. The damage has been done that's been done to the environment. The only thing we should have to talk to the Saudis about is, hey, How's that patch of tree growing that you guys planted? Because ours is going pretty good in this sector, but we're really going to need a little more water in that sector.
Yeah.
And in a sane world, that's where we are. So I liked to go into alliteration and the technology of the mechanisms of war in this thing from a
this
different angle.
This thing is Bob Honey, who just do stuff. That's this thing, and that's Sean Penn.
Get the book, folks.
Get the book. It's a glorious read.
Yeah.
And work. But
worth it. But worth it. You'll earn it.
But I think you have the feeling of accomplishment when you swallow it. And I love this time we spend together. Thank you. That's all of the above.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you both.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Gettlein.
And life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.
New to Podcast One, The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Join Todd as he interviews the biggest names in Hollywood, like Adam Sandler.
We drove down there and my brother's like, do you have your material? I said, what do you mean?
Rebel Wilson.
I couldn't interact with these people, so I put on this American accent and pretended to be American.
And Isla Fisher.
I just wrote a passionate letter explaining how much I wanted to be a clown, begging them to accept me.
Download new episodes of The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, or Apple Podcasts.